/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Souls, a Celebration Works concert series by Resonance Ensemble on Sunday, February 25th at 2 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church in Portland. Souls explores the mystical traditions of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity with their common threads of selflessness and compassion. The centerpiece of the concert will be Portland composer Teresa Coons, Where Everything is Music, a cycle of 12 Sufi pieces for choir with soloists. Again, that's Souls, a Celebration Works concert series by Resonance Ensemble on Sunday, February 25th at 2 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church, 1200 Southwest Alder Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right-hand side of the homepage, click under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and While Rome Burns are proud to co-sponsor a concert with the Reverb Brothers and Metropolitan Farms to benefit Rose Haven on Sunday, February 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza and Pub in Portland. The Reverb Brothers play a blend of 30s jazz and blues, traditional country, New Orleans R&B, rock and roll, soul, their take on Americana. Metropolitan Farms play a mix between 80s college rock and pop, Britpop, and 70s West Coast rock. The show is a benefit for Rose Haven, which serves women and children experiencing the trauma of abuse, loss of home, and other disruptive life challenges. Again, that's the Reverb Brothers and Metropolitan Farms to benefit Rose Haven on Sunday, February 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza and Pub, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is building a city of media makers. We believe that strong, resilient communities know how to make their own media. For 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep the city activated and aware through radio we make together. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Welcome to Talking Earth. I'm Patrick Picard. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial. And I have the good fortune to be here in the studio, or rather be here in the studio last week while recording with Matthew Minicucci. He is the author of one previous collection of poetry translation published by Kent State University Press 2015, chosen by Jane Hirschfield for the 2014 WIC Poetry Prize. He is the recipient of fellowships and awards from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the WIC Poetry Center, and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I just mispronounced that, didn't I?
Oh, yeah, no, but everyone does. It's a tough one.
Urbana?
Urbana.
Where he received his MFA.
Yes.
His work has appeared in numerous journals and anthologies, including Best New Poets 2014, the Gettysburg Review, Kenyon Review, the Southern Review, and Virginia Quarterly Review. Currently lives in Portland, Oregon, with his partner Elizabeth and their cat, Puck. He is also the author of Small Gods, which came out in February or...
October 3rd.
Ooh, excuse me.
Yeah, it was a little while ago. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then he also just won... a literary arts fellowship?
Yeah, an Oregon literary fellowship from literary arts and poetry. Yeah.
Okay, I'm mispronouncing everything today.
No. Yeah, it's all...
So I'm going to step out of the way and let Matthew read three or four of his poems from Small Gods, and then perhaps we'll pick up there in the conversation.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'd like to just start with the first poem in Small Gods. It's called Paul's Letter to the Romans. What if I told you desire is something with lips, something ancient, cavernous, and filled with tepid water, transparent, eyeless fish? What if it wasn't skin or its lack that pushed you away? What if loss was something more than your bronze gods, porcine, and bright, the stink of some world hanging off the end of a spear. What if I could offer you doubt's long sands, burnt temple, a body lost to the sap of trees? What if the small flash of emptiness at the back of the knee fired the heart of this king, this graceful thing, and each time you approached it was given love like an oil lamp? What if less or fewer or nothing could be augured and birds were, next to him, the closest thing? What if no flesh was asked for except this? This night caught in the belly that bore it. What if all this time you were already home? What would you be willing to burn to light it? The body. Sometimes you put it aside, the body, I mean. Sometimes ignored the way you stumble through a grove of trees. But that's a lie. There are no trees here, no giant sequoia, no unglaciated ridges or valleys. I often lie to you. I've often said that I've understood what you've offered to a conversation, nodded in agreement. But really, I've heard nothing. And this reminds me most of wind. I wish I could tell you why. Maybe it's all better that way, as wind. Maybe I'm a sail, or just its luff. Or maybe I'm nothing at all. What I mean to say is, perhaps I'm most like my grandfather, who fell in the shower yesterday, in the home he's forced to live in, and pulled the cord that lines the floor of every room in those sorts of homes. And of course they tell us he'll be fine. Fine is what they say, and he tells us nothing at all, because perhaps there is nothing to tell. Perhaps there's nothing but wind, and that's why it's all he can ever hear. Just do one more.
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. Proverbs. Let's not talk about how much has been left on the porch, the rocks in the vase, the case made each day no better with time. In rhyme, I always hate myself, drowning in a shallow pool just to be thought a fool again, fooled, of course, in the long, dark spool of night. Consider how a hand brushes against another and how that is almost nothing. This morning, a cat walks carefully through the white yard, unsure of each step, and yes, she reminds me of you. I want to take her in. Eat this, the body says, and stay. In the end, any breath left is wasted, so let me be clear. Tracks in the snow indicate at least some life, and this is intimate. How what's empty is always cavernous, no matter how delicately placed.
I like that one a lot, actually. That was one of the highlights I picked out. You only read from the first section, though, yeah. Which is interesting. And there are three distinct sections, and two of them involve Paul's letters.
Yes.
The Pauline letters.
Yes.
And then the middle section is about the Greek alphabet, sort of.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, I was just wondering how... I'm kind of curious because I'm not very well-versed with the Pauline letters, even sure. though I'm kind of raised Catholic. I should be, but I'm not. And I've been trying to figure out their relation to the pieces you read.
Absolutely.
Or in the book.
Yeah.
Did you have anything to speak to on that? Or?
I do. So... Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. Basically, you have three sections, and the first section and the third section are very clearly have some faith-based elements, especially given. So there's quite a few books named after books of the Bible. I do almost every of the Pauline letters, not all of them, but almost all of them. And then the center section is one poem for every letter of the Greek alphabet. So eventually, I'll be honest with you, they started as two separate projects. But I realized that they were talking about the same thing using very different methods.
About faith and relationships?
They were definitely both talking about loss.
Okay.
And I realized that the place where loss intersected for me in my upbringing, which was 12 years of Catholic school and all that sort of stuff.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of Catholic school.
I went through a lot of Catholic school too.
Oh, you, brother. I feel like I realized that both of them were trying to deal with the concept of loss. And I thought that perhaps the epistemologies perhaps that we develop and languages that we develop to talk about this kind of intersect for both of these things that we wouldn't consider related at all, right? People are, say, faith is on one side and science is on the other, but they're both ways of trying to understand something. And for this book, I think they're both trying to understand loss.
And the middle section is very much scientifically.
100%.
There's a lot of scientific and physics. And
astronomy, physical sciences, natural sciences, mathematics, pretty much everything. It took a very long time to write.
While we're discussing the book instead of having you read it, one other thing I wanted to ask you about was whether, I think all of the Paul's letter to the Ephesians, of your pieces named for Paul, the Pauline letters, they all seem to be prose poems. Is that actually correct or am I wrong?
No, you're 100% right. They are prose poems. And prose poems, if you read my first book translation, there are scattered prose poems. There's quite a few in the center section, but it's a lot more lineated work. And as I started working on Small Gods, I actually thought at some point it would only be prose poems. But it ended up not quite fitting what I was trying to do with the content, but the entire center section is nothing but prose poems. And there was an attempt to remove the lineation but continue to use very obvious poetic devices, anaphora, consonants, assonants, alliteration, all the things that you would know. And all of those techniques, how would they function in a sort of non-lineated form, would
so
that change things?
A lot of the prose poems that are in the book started out as regular lineated poems?
They didn't. No, they didn't, but I made a very conscious effort to be very mindful of sound while I was working on them.
That comes through in just about everything in the book, actually.
Thanks.
The middle passages, too, with the scientific
I appreciate
words,
that.
They...
I was hoping to make something beautiful out of a language that felt sterile. Sometimes I think, I don't know, if we get to reading some of those, we can talk a little about that center section, because there's a lot of complications when I go to readings and I read from it. People will, well, did you study science? Are you a scientist? And my response is no. In fact, the poems, the speaker in the poems is very much alerting you as the reader, often saying, I don't actually know this. I wish I did. But the thing that the speaker also doesn't know is why the separation is happening between this other that he keeps speaking of. So,
well, that reminds me of one of the poems, actually, is kind of changes the, and I wish I could remember which the title, but I think, oh, yes, it's Upsilon.
Oh, absolutely.
If you want to read it.
I would love
now
to.
Or,
yeah, I would
yeah,
love
but
to.
That one is very much like it changes the speaker.
Absolutely.
We'll let you the readers listen to it first.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It's one of my favorites, so thank you for pulling that one out. So the letter is Upsilon, which is very close to the end of the second section. Regarding this apartment's spatial volume, too much mass, not enough luminosity. By which I mean the porch light was out when I got back. By which I mean you weren't there. There's no need for photometry to measure that flux. Maybe all this time you were the trap standing wave. Sure, I can give you that. Maybe in the end, it was always about boundary conditions. Did you know that some insignificant matter between a distant source and a sole observer can bend light itself? This is not a metaphor. To the observer, that light would look so much like a ring, all fucking axially symmetrical. This is, again, not a metaphor. Maybe misalignment. Maybe just an arc segment, as it turns out. Maybe every word you said to me about him set in my skin like a secant line and cut like its Latin root. Or maybe I lied. Maybe that matter between some distant source and this sole observer is significant after all. Maybe it's massive. Maybe it's some mass M at some distance R, where G is the universal constant of gravitation, C the speed of light, and I, well, I'm torn like time itself.
I like that one, but the speaker, it changes the realizes that a black hole is supposed to be massive.
Absolutely.
Although it doesn't take up much space.
Absolutely.
It just eats space.
Yeah.
Or space-time.
Yeah. No, there was something about the notion that something could be massive and yet could be, you know, yeah, this tiny little crack that seemed to take up everything.
And it was connected with the porch light being out when he got back.
Absolutely.
And a loss.
Yeah, no. And it's funny. I'll occasionally read four or five of these at a reading, you know, at a bar or a bookstore. And often this will be the last one that I read. And very often people will laugh when I have this very too much mass, not enough luminosity, by which I mean the porch light was out when I got back. And people see that as this moment of levity, and there is levity in it, that sometimes the light is out just because somebody forgot to switch on the light, but what are the implications?
It's also about
that?
The death of a star, so it's kind of the entire
Absolutely.
Thing's about loss.
Excellent, excellent. No, yeah. I 100% agree. Yeah, 100%.
If you want to read more from Small Gods or from translation right now, that's either, yeah, it's up to you.
I'd love to do a couple more from the center section, if that would be all right.
Oh, it'd be great.
Yeah. I'll do a few from the earlier part of that project. So again, in terms of the project, I think it's really important for the listener, reader, to remember that every single one of these Greek letters, in every single poem, all of the images that are scientifically based, mathematics, astronomy, etc., they all can be symbolically placed by the letter itself. So beta stands in for all of these concepts, and gamma stands in for all of these concepts, things like radiation, things like a star placement, things like gravity.
There's a history of that word tied in with
absolutely
physics and language in the English
absolutely
language as well.
100%. And it's and the symbol is sort of a symbol, I think, that the speaker is trying to grapple with, how one word can mean so many massive things and so many tiny things at the same time. So this one is called Beta. The first day, unclear, and each day after, Selenic. Nothing but oceans and craters. Sidereal days, synodic nights, the world quartered by distant stars. Now ours was a history of apparent size, of lying to the sky. A history of light reflected. History nothing but the voiced bilabial plosive, by which I mean the voice track occlusive, all airflow ceased, by which I mean I don't know what to say. For any two variables, we can estimate the change and relationships between. You called this regression, linear and simple. I called it the steps to your apartment, the locked door, how exchange glances become the barycenter of balanced and balancing bodies. But the truth is, a first morning together is always multinomial. There are such discrete possible outcomes. Perhaps it's only supposed to be a moment, all just aleatory in the end. Perhaps it's about how you decide to partition the probability space of an egg, double yolk, sunny side up, what you might call the problem of two bodies, but what I decided to name the tide.
The tide is a... Sorry for interrupting.
No, please do.
The tide is the problem of two bodies.
100%. It's weird to think of it that way, though, right? I think the moment when I was a kid that I realized that we had tide because of this other...
Well, the thing is, though, is that I'm not sure that... I can't remember. I remember this as a criticism of a Larry Niven story that won a Hugo Neutron Star, where... Sure. It's kind of a detective story, and the main character realizes because of everything he's gone through, and he barely survives what he went through, to discover the puppeteers are alien species, and they make this hull that's almost indestructible, and it got destroyed, and they're wondering why, because it went by a neutron star, and they're wondering what got within it, and it was the tide. And the problem is that at the end of the story, the narrator uses it to bilk the puppeteers because he's like, I know that you live on a planet without a moon because otherwise you'd know what a tide is.
Sure.
But that's not actually true. People criticize the story for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure.
That's interesting. Yeah. No, yeah.
So everyone out there has got to look that up now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're just giving everyone an assignment.
Okay. Yes, we have an assignment. Report back in March.
Absolutely, yeah. Trying to think of what would be where I would normally go to. How about ETA, which is ETA? Lately, distance traveled. A lone observer in the long gray age of the universe. There is a maximum space between you and the bedside lamp unlit. For every particle and particular light, Y is true. Y could be some boundary, undefined, between the canoed curves in the bed. Unobservable regions, space as entirely conformal. All the angles right, all these distances distorted. Leaving, you argued the value of a neutral axis, how there must mathematically be a place where no strain exists. Another day, it seems. Another bright star. Electrons per photon, amps per watt. The kindness of thermodynamics, how each system is a state, each state only one in a cycle, each cycle returning finally to an initial condition, or some such nonsense. I'm sure that I wasn't listening, lost in elasticity, response observed in one variable as defined by the change in another. Gradient decrease in the inevitable passing of this to that. Sometimes each set seen only an adjunction, spoken word on the non-essential attribute of a thing. How the lamp, how it still sits there, how it hasn't worked for days. I think one of the things that the hope when reading in this section is that the reader will see almost the history of the moments that happen for the speaker in trying to make sense of the dissolution of a relationship. I think when that's happening, or at least when that's happened to me long ago in the past, there's been this grasping at all kinds of information that perhaps if I went to this, it would make more sense, or I went to this, it would make more sense, or if I could just understand X, or if I could just understand Y, then it's not that I could solve the equation, but at least I'd have fewer variables. At least I would be one step closer to perhaps solving it.
Yeah, you'd know more.
Yeah, exactly. And that extra information would somehow bring me closer to at least a chance that I could figure it out. I'd love to read this poem. There's a break in this second section, and when it starts up again, I think one of the more important poems is this poem, Omicron. I'd like to read that one. It tells you a little bit more, perhaps, about the moment where things perhaps change for the speaker. So, Omicron. We don't talk about it, but there's an order of operations to leaving. Calculate, divide, deal with the variables. Taping the bottom of each box before the top. Of course. Of course, it's all just random which side we choose. It's just where we decide to make our mark. We're foolish, you and I, and we do foolish things. When you told me about him, foolish him, I could only respond in the vocative, oh, oh, Omicron, Omega, the smallest of things and the biggest. The furthest star in any constellation group is still brighter than anything you've ever imagined, but is only punctuation to the sky. Giant, fiery, and ancient punctuation. Eventually, perhaps inevitably, we arbitrarily approach the limit of this function. We can try to find where there's still growth if and only if there exist positive numbers, but we both know the argument is tending towards infinity. All simpler functions seem spent. Sufficiently large, suitably close. It seems, once again, we're left with X.
No, I don't. I'm kind of left.
Okay,
speechless. A
little. No, no. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I think that's one. I don't know. If you're reading through, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what a reader out there thought. But when I'm reading that through, when I was going through like the editing process, and you know, you're on version 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and doing all of that stuff, this is sort of one of those climax moments for me where. I think of a dramatic climax as in a play where a character makes a decision that they realize they can never come back from, and the rest of the play is sort of the resolution of that decision.
Oh, I very much agree with that. And in fact, actually, you kind of let off a little bit of steam with the next one.
Absolutely. No,
if you wanted to read that or not, you could leave it mysterious. Like, much of your book is very mysterious. And to me, at least, it seems like.
Yeah.
There's a mystery there, which is kind of nice.
Actually, I would love to read this one just because I'd like to talk about it just for 1 second. So after Omicron, if anybody out there in the listening crowd is a big Greek alphabet fan, you probably know that the next letter is pi. Of course, Pi Day is coming up. It's only like a month from now. There's a Pi Day, so
that's
on March 14th, right?
Shouldn't it be a Pi Second?
Exactly. Pi, the poem is, at some point, you just stop counting. And you're exactly right. It is absolutely letting off steam. It also, if I can maybe let everybody in or let you, Patrick, in on the writing process, it was pretty much the last poem of the series I wrote. So did not write them in order in any way.
Makes sense.
But at some point, I had a group of 7 that was left to do, and they were so famous. Like, there were so many connotations to them that I didn't know how to do them at all. And Pi was the last one. I was like, everyone, people have Pi shirts. There's a movie called Pi. You know, there's all this. There's a Pi Day. People, you know, like, have shirts that have the, like, every digit for the first, like, 80 digits of Pi. I'm like, how am I going to write a poem? And I realized that pressure... Exactly right. That pressure after Omicron should be released in the simplest way possible. With Pi, at some point, you just stop counting, right?
Of course, they didn't, and they actually discovered the end, I think, didn't they?
Oh, did they? See, I don't. This
I
is
thought
great.
They
I
did.
This.
Maybe
if they
I'm
did,
wrong.
That's amazing, and perhaps...
Yeah, then we would actually have the Pi nanosecond or whatever.
Sure.
They would know exactly at what... Yeah.
Where you can go. That's... Yeah. I think so at the time, if I can give a shout-out, I was living in Champaign, Illinois at the time. This was before I came, so this was years ago. And a good friend of mine, Zach McVicker, and John Dudek, two good friends of mine who are both great poets, we were sitting having a drink at a bar, and I could not figure out this poem. And I was like, do you have any ideas? Do you have any? And I think we sort of talked about it, and somewhere in the middle of like drink number three, it's like, you know, at some point you just kind of have to stop counting, you know, and that became the poem. So I dedicate the poem to Zach McVicker in the back of the book, although John should also get credit for that. But yeah, that was maybe, I don't know if you ever had this feeling.
So they both get shout outs.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever had the feeling where sometimes you don't know how to figure out a problem. If you're writing or if you're working on something, and then all of a sudden you realize, actually, maybe just saying that I don't know how to figure out the problem is part of figuring out the problem.
Actually, yeah, I did. Yeah. I did do that. And then I read that piece and nobody got it.
Oh, no.
I mean, I hate to say this. I read at a reading. I shouldn't talk that much about myself.
No,
but I read at a reading this kind of weird ghost story set in my old college and in upstate New York, and the two main characters, so the main character was African-American, mm-hmm. and nobody got that he was African-American.
That's interesting.
And I was like, fail.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
And I actually say it in the middle. That's what I did, is I said like the usual metafictional thing, except I tweaked it to be like, obviously this white author has no idea how to write. That's, and it was true.
Yeah, so commenting on the shortcomings.
On the failure, and they didn't even get that.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, they all like clapped, and then like, oh, did you guys get that? No.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that's buried somewhere.
Yeah.
Not published.
Well, that's an interesting example.
Enough of my writing. Yeah, let's. Yeah. Do you want? Okay, now you can keep reading from Small Gods, actually.
Yeah, would you? Sure. Some more. How about, maybe one or two that I never get a chance to read.
Go for it. Now's your time to read them.
Right.
I'm not going to stop you at all.
Lovely. I do two. So this poem comes right after Upsilon. It's Phi, P-H-I. And I always, for some reason, never get a chance to read it, and I always really like it. So Phi. Excuse me. Easy. Like always, lacks latitude and roll angle. It's just some damn geodesy. In the end, we were always about pressure, real divided by the ideal, characteristic function, normal distribution. The predicate logic of a yard's paper birch. For example, for each yellow-horned lark, there exists a pennyworth piece of bark. Simple. But I did not tell you this. Instead, I remembered just how important prepositions are, closest to or furthest from. Don't worry, it isn't just us. Every kind of science measures the void eventually. Here is just our particular porosity. The truth is, I never know what to say to the sky. Irreducible sun, roots in their complex union, sad, mislaid, multiplicative identity. This cardinal number, that ordinal street. When you called, you made leaving sound as generic as flying. Look, people do it all the time. But what if, all this time, flying was just falling towards something else? What if they lied to us? People do it all the time. Here's one other I never get a chance to read, and it's my own fault, because obviously you can choose your own reading materials. I don't know why sometimes I get into where I'm like, these are the six that I'm going to read, and it's just, I feel so comfortable with them. But this is the last poem of that second section. So Omega, another one that was wrought with a lot of expectations. The end, Janus faced cliche, the eschatology of a door, hinge pin rolling across the floor, lost to a solid angle subtended. Or the multiplicity of moving furniture, microstates uncertain in a living room's dusty system. Boxes stacked, waiting to be filled, object, object, sub-object. So much like bodies intertwined, you say, how one always fits inside another. But maybe you say none of this. Maybe what's left is just some turbulent apology or topology. the perceived properties of space preserved. When there's turbulence, there's also a specific rate of dissipation, pressure changing with respect to time. For example, how a parcel of air seems to traverse the space between two open windows without incident. Such streamlines and streak lines and path lines, probability that any randomly constructed program will suddenly halt. High energy, but short-lived. The simple division of a last night together. How for every number n, there are x prime factors that divide the integer exactly. How you could see them when you closed your eyes, branching like beetroot. How you told me you can dream of nothing else.
You're listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bacard. You have been listening to Matthew Minicucci read from his new book, Small Gods, that came out last November or October.
October, yeah.
Yes.
Crazy.
It's been a long time coming to being on the air.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And perhaps he will read from his first book translation.
I would love to.
Go for it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to interrupt you with a question yet.
All right. Questions are coming, but not quite yet. So the first book, that's funny. I would preview it. We were sort of in a bookstore at a reading, so I figure I should preview it anyways. But translation, the best way that I could describe it is trying to come to grips with the dissolution of my nuclear family through predominantly classical mythology. So I study classics as an undergrad. I study Greek and Latin. And when I got to grad school, I saw poetry and classics as sort of separate for a lot of reasons that perhaps I can't talk about on the air, but for a lot.
Perhaps you could, but go ahead.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. But I think I was just putting a lot of pressure on myself to what qualified as an, what is an intellectual poem? Can a poem be too intellectual? And I realized through the help of a lot of really great teachers and a lot of really great moments while I was building this first book, translation, that the perfect moment was the intersection of these two things. I wanted to find a way to talk about my family, and I wanted to find a way to talk about this thing I really cared about, which is sort of Greek mythology, Homeric writing, Greek and Latin, and I figured out that those two things intersected more than I thought. So a lot of that happened here in this book. So I might just read the first, there's a prologue poem that perhaps gives you an idea of what the aim of the book is. It's called epithet, epithet is a complicated word because we have a very specific use of it in English, but as a note, a Homeric epithet would be a bit of language that stands in for the name of a hero or a god. For example, swift-footed Achilles or...
So it wasn't quite a poem, but it was kind of a poetical phrase.
So exactly. So it would be it was actually a metrical function. So it would stand in to make the meter work correctly in Homeric Greek. But it also suggests a lot about the history of textualization and the history of the fact that all of Homer is an oral tradition, right? So all of these things were around a campfire, people are drinking beers, having a good time, and so a lot of that. So it's just important, I think, to know that epithet, when I say epithet, I'm
thinking, a different meaning than the current usage.
Absolutely, and there's probably some interaction there, but this poem is called Epithet, and it starts with a quote from Heraclitus. The sea is both pure and tainted, healthy and good haven to the fish, and to men impotable and deadly. Epithet. If you're Achilles, water is something you struggle with, whether tears or angry river. Your mother loves only the sea. Your mother is subordinate to the sea, but isn't everything. When you heard the news, when you saw how much of your friend they took, the tent was the first to go. Shatter this, rip that, throw what's left into the sea, a swatch of fabric for you, grandfather. Cover your white foam knuckles, keep fighting bluff and shore like this one, where everything we've ruined comes back to us, all wheel and yoke and wooden buckle, all bronze arrow and horsehair plume, our war machines, our fishing lures, the best parts of ourselves, pocked with rust and half buried in the sand. Trying to give that idea of the family sort of right off the bat, but
yeah, but it also has a feeling. Well, it's the Trojan War, so
absolutely 100%, right? I've had interesting responses again from readers or from readings that I've gone to where the Achilles sort of struggling with water, sort of like, what do you mean by that? And I'm like, well, if your legendary weakness is your Achilles heel and it's because you weren't fully dipped into the river, then water has caused you some problems, hasn't it? So sort of interesting. another one?
Yeah. No, good. Please. We got plenty of time. So.
Excellent. This poem was briefly the name of the book. And I had a brief conversation with my editor with the notion that perhaps we couldn't name the book that, or perhaps it wouldn't be the best name for the book. I think later just sort of realized that it might be too aggressive a move for a first book. But the name of the book is called, or the name of the poem is called Brief Song of the Almost Lost. Maybe just reaching a bit too far, but Brief Song of the Almost Lost. Less to say in winter, to be sure. Less to consider and less appears beneath the debris that still somehow collects. We connect, briefly. We fan out like the tail of a cornered animal, though not so cornered as it thinks. The things said in context. Trail left behind. I've decided to follow my mother's advice. Guilt. Nothing else to be transcribed as the bottle bleeds out. Nothing more to say about the past. Once, I studied all the long-forgotten kings. I gathered what few fragments remained of their tongue. Brief song of the almost lost. Mothers putting to rest their sons.
Yeah. So, do you want to read another one out of the...
Please.
Out of translation?
I'd love to.
I mean, I do have a question when you're done, but...
Okay. Let's do one more. I would love to read this poem, because I do read it often, but you heard at least one grandfather poem from Small Gods, and there's a note in the back of Small Gods that my grandfather passed away a little while ago now, but in the moments sort of leading up to losing him were the moments that I was putting together these books, and I was thinking about him a lot. And this poem relates a couple of stories. One is the great king of Troy, Priam, who at the end of the Iliad has to go and beg for his son's body back from Achilles. Achilles has defeated Hector. He's dragged the body around. He's holding it in his tent. And Priam has to go supplicate himself to the man who killed his own son for the body. And for my grandfather, I was thinking, my uncle Peter, who I never met, passed away when my father was young. So of course I never got a chance to meet him. But he passed away in a motorcycle accident. And I was thinking very much about what is the moment of that loss where you have to go, perhaps, and identify, or you get called to the scene, or you get called to the hospital. I obviously can't begin to understand such a thing, but watching my grandfather get older and having to live with the fact that his son, his oldest son, had been dead for so many years, I guess I thought about Priam very much. And so this is called Priam, and it's for my grandfather. If you watched him clip his suspenders, you'd understand how the left pinky knots and bends like the base of a juniper, grazes the tin clasp again and again till some brief connection of metal to cloth. And there's no mirror or the papery fingers of his wife, just time and breath waiting for each tide to recoil against black ships, to touch once more the long line of his son's cheekbone, to see if his beard still grows, despite the cold, like scrub or sagebrush. If you lost a son in traffic, you'd understand. Slow motion, falling metal, the dirt-caked wheel and fork that welded to the side of the truck, how it buckled like tent posts, or worn hulls, or copper fasteners reaching out from each board like buttons. Riding breath, riding waves of salt water in rhythm against sand and seam until clamped shut like the fists of some boy king painted with his son's blood. If you watched him, you'd understand that it's not in spite, but because of this, that he kissed the driver's hands who had dragged him for blocks.
Wow. Very moving. So I had a question. You actually had a question. Yeah. Or a topic you wanted to discuss, and you felt it wasn't okay to say it, talk about it on the radio. And sure. I'm curious, and I'm sure our listeners are curious. Why did you feel that classics and poetry should be kept apart? Is that the phrase you used? Or
yeah, that was definitely the phrase. So I think it's a complicated question, and I think probably has a lot to do with the way perhaps I felt I was trained in poetry. So as a classicist. Of course, I was only an undergrad classicist. I never went to grad school for it. But the training was massively intense. When I learned Greek, we had Greek every single day for an hour and 15 minutes for two straight semesters. So you got four semesters of Greek in as quickly as humanly possible, basically.
Wow.
And it was the only way it could work for me because I'm actually not that great at languages. It's weird that I became a poet.
I have a lot of problems with languages too. I relate to that.
Okay.
And I also feel, I didn't take German every day. So I, sehr schlecht. Go ahead.
No, absolutely. I think when I was in high schooler, I took Spanish. And I was always a very average student. I had a very hard time with it. I always thought I'd be bad at it. But I loved Greek and I loved Latin. Full disclosure, I actually failed Greek the first time I took it. But my professor was kind enough to let me try again. And I really committed myself. It was less about me not being good at Greek and more about me sleeping till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Because it was like the second semester of my freshman year. Which is a kind of privilege, of course. But taking it again, I did much better. And I think I expected that kind of training when I went to grad school for poetry, because I have a weird sort of history with poetry. I studied classics and then I left school for about 5 years and I thought about going back to school, but I never thought about going to school for writing. I wrote in my own time. I wrote listening to Elliot Smith, you know, like I being sad in my room, and I never thought it was a thing that I would share with somebody else or that I would be trained formally in. I didn't think it was a thing anyone trained formally in. I wasn't aware of that. And when I did decide to go to school and was lucky enough to get in to a few places, by the way, including the University of Oregon, it was between the University of Illinois and University of Oregon for me to go to my MFA. So I could have been an Oregonian much sooner. But I ended up going to Illinois, which was a great decision. But there was this sort of notion for me of killing the past. You know, it's like watching The Last Jedi, kill the past, right? Like, I don't know.
Now I can understand it. It's that you don't want to tread where Homer and Sappho.
Very much.
And many other poets that I forgot that have Anne Carson knows and writes about.
Absolutely.
You don't want to tread there because it's pretty hard to beat them.
I think that's a great, and I definitely felt that way. And Anne Carson's a really great example because I don't think I was introduced to Carson until maybe a year into my program. And I, of course, immediately fell in love with all of Anne Carson's work and thought it was just the most amazing thing I had ever read. I think maybe even more than that, though, it wasn't that I was afraid of not being able to keep up with it. It was that the kind of training I received was that if you over-intellectualized a poem, if you over-researched a poem, that you would somehow, the spirit of it would be lost somewhere. This idea, I always, my partner Elizabeth and I, we talk about this all the time. I always use this metaphor when I played baseball as a kid, like a lot of kids, you know, little league and senior league and those kinds of things. And I was always told not to grip a bat too tight. Always. Like, don't grip the bat too tight. You can't see me doing it, but I'm holding my fist in the studio. But
I never got that introduction, you know. But yeah. I was never very good at athletics either. So
I mean, I think the advice made sense, that if you grip the bat too tight, you wouldn't be able to swing in a sort of loose, natural way. And that was the advice I got for the most part when I first got into poetry. The teachers I had were amazing teachers, but their philosophy and the philosophy that worked for them was one of sort of do it and do it and do it and then let it go. Don't think of, let it go, you know, just let it happen. And I get that writing is in some ways about letting it happen. If you just keep rewriting the same sentence over and over again, you're only ever going to write one sentence. But at the same time, that's not the way my brain works. And I think I eventually realized that I needed to go out and grasp all of these things that were important to me. And it's the intersection of those things, not the releasing completely of them, but bringing them together. That's what really, I think I'm a Lego builder, not a, I don't know what the other, but
I think actually there's some truth to that. And it sometimes, unfortunately, an aspiring writer can actually have teachers that are maybe good teachers, but they're inimical. Their actual what works for them and what they know doesn't work for the writer. For instance, I mean, I'm thinking of Clive Barker studying under John Gardner. It'd be kind of terrible for both of them.
Fascinating. That's
a
great example.
John Gardner probably would have understood that it was not good, but yeah, and not always. I've had a couple bad workshops, and I've had I had one bad workshop really, and that was kind of, it wasn't bad for me. It was bad for other people, unfortunately. Yeah. But yeah, and I think you got to figure out what works for yourself. Yeah.
I didn't realize that they were student and teacher, John Gardner and
no, Clive they weren't. Barker. No, Clive Barker was in Liverpool and John Gardner was in the Midwest taught. And no, John Gardner never taught. In fact, he died before in the motorcycle accident before.
Strangely,
I went to school at SUNY Binghamton, and John Gardner had taught there before I went there, and that's why.
That's interesting. That's a great.
And I also been reading Clive Barker lately. You got to find a teacher that fits you in some ways, and also you have to find what works for you as a method of writing. And I guess that leads up to a question I didn't write down, which is how do you have any kind of ritual of writing? Do you write every day? Do you write like a specific, like type into a computer or write on with a pen or a pencil?
It's very interesting. I it's changed over the years. Like it changes, I would say every 6 months. I feel like I'm a timeshare of writing styles or of writing sort of habits. Like I stay in a place and then I'm like, I don't like this place anymore. I'm going to go somewhere else. but for a slightly longer than in the past, I've been in this place where almost everything gets typed out first. And I basically save multiple cascading versions of different of the same poem. And so like when I'm building a manuscript, for example, there'll just be like 50 folders on my desktop, and each of those folders is filled with, you know, innumerable versions. But the real method that I sort of employ most often is, I don't think I like this terminology, but it's the only way I can think to describe it, is sort of a sculpting terminology. So I do keep a notebook with me, and I gather a lot of pieces, lines, observations, ideas, and then I'll type all of that out in these huge blocks. So I'll have a huge block of text that fills up a whole page. And then I basically will go through and cut out the things.
You carve the stuff out.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been told that I misquote this, but it's the sort of, you know, the Michelangelo just carve inside the block what doesn't look like the statue. I'm not sure if that's apocryphal or not, but that's how it feels for me.
It works, so yeah, why not?
Writing a poem, that's how I feel, that there's a poem there. I just need to figure out what it is and how it works.
So we only have a couple more minutes. I'll probably ask you one more question.
Sure.
I've already asked a bunch of questions that are on my list. What would you say are your major poetic and literary influences? And are you also influenced by philosophers?
That's great. It's funny so now I feel like I've had a chance to read and meet so many people that there are a lot of amazing authors right now, poets, who are working in the kinds of genres that I'm interested in, not genres, but the kinds of sort of inspirations that I'm interested in, like classical sort of mythology and things like that. So Carl Phillips comes to mind always, who was a huge inspiration for me when I was first starting out. And Kathleen Graber, who teaches at VCU, she had this amazing book called The Eternal City, which, among other things, has this amazing series of poems, one for every book of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations.
Wow. Okay.
It's also, I believe, her cleaning out basically the garage after her mother has passed away. Cool. So it's interesting to bring those two things together. And those two authors, very specifically, my teacher in grad school was Bridget Pajean Kelly. And she was a huge inspiration. I think her book Song is perhaps the greatest book written by an American poet in the 20th century. I would die on that hill.
Okay.
So
hear that, listeners. Got to go find that at Powell's now.
Yeah, it's
Translation, which translation you're going to have to order from the online.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Or if you come see me read, maybe I'll have copies with me.
Or many other bookstores out there too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe some of them have translation.
Yeah. Yeah. And those would be a couple of the sort of big, it was interesting when I first got to grad school because I hadn't really read a lot of poets because I had studied classics. And people, who's your favorite poet? I'd be like, Homer, you know, and the people are like, oh, that's a weirdly, I don't know, arrogant thing to say. I never thought of it that way. I just genuinely really liked Homer. I think when your loves are these super, what people consider to be super intellectual things, especially sort of Western civ oriented things, there's perhaps a reaction that that Homer isn't cool anymore. But I was glad to find poets who were interested in doing what I was interested in doing.
I don't see how someone saying their favorite poet is Homer or Sappho being arrogant.
I appreciate you saying that.
I'm surprised someone, I can understand some critique over that, but that's different. That's a different critique than arrogance.
To be fair, the critique might be in my head too, but I did feel as though my training was so different than my classmates when I first starting studying poetry, that they had been writing and reading contemporary poetry. You know, I recall having a conversation where someone was sort of aghast that I hadn't read Tender Buttons or something like that, or that I, you know, hadn't read Robert Lowell, and I was like, I will. And that's what I did, by the way, in my three years of grad school, is I just read everything I could possibly get my hands on because I just had never had the opportunity. So, yeah, there's a lot of classical stuff that I like too.
So I'm going to have you read one more poem to end the show in just a minute. But I do have to ask you, do you have any readings coming up?
So I'm trying to think of what the reading schedule currently is. I was actually going to read at the Vancouver, Washington Barnes & Noble, I believe on January 30th, but the reading sadly was canceled. So I will be reading there, but not until this summer.
Okay.
In terms of other things, there are some things that are not fully confirmed yet, but it look like they'll be happening. But if you go to my website, which is just my full name, MatthewMinicucci.com, there's always a full tour.
So that's Matthew, MatthewHEW. MinicuCci.com.
Absolutely. There's always a full tour schedule there. There's always audio, video that's updated there, new publications. And as things get confirmed, then I can actually fully say, yes, this is going to happen in town or even out of town. I'll have that updated there.
Okay. I think we have time for just one more poem.
Excellent. I want to read the final poem in Small Gods. And it is based on a Pauline letter as well, and it's called Philemon. History is a hum. You must understand. Each of us is unmade by the sight of the angel strings, the dulcet beat of its wings. Every announcement, only bad news, of course. A husband's ship come to port, each man to blood, a mother's blinding brooch. The ubiquitous children lost. It's just story, you know. No guardian, no just juxtaposition of sorrow on stage. Story. Standing water complete with swallowtails. Simple facts, unsympathetic. In time, the skin is a vellum that we read. Indeed, every word a step from ship to shore. Madness to men like us interred in some granite mortuary. Go. Go and tell them that here I will lie mournful. No stone in this box left unstudied. Each just another cold iris for the world.
I'd like to thank our guest tonight, Matthew Minicucci.
Patrick, thank you for having me.
Thanks. And you've been listening to Talking Earth. This is KBL Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. Please stay tuned for the next show.
For decades, KBL News and Public Affairs has welcomed radical and spirited activists in the Northwest and beyond. KBL is central to connecting the world to what is happening in Portland and the Northwest. We put the mic in everyone's hands. Help amplify the stories of people in your own backyard. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Gala Night, Mandela's Legacy Centennial, February 23rd at 8 p.m. at No Vacancy Lounge in Portland. Pan-African Gala Night will feature the Haitian band Solo African, a DJ from Ghana, and other DJs playing Afro world music. That's the Pan-African Gala Night, Mandela's Legacy Centennial, on February 23rd at 8 p.m. at No Vacancy Lounge at 235 Southwest 1st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Afro-Latin Funk Night with New Triumph on February 8th at the Goodfoot in Portland. Afro-Latin Funk with New Triumph will be featuring some of the best players in Seattle's vibrant music scene. Enjoy a night of energetic, danceable, intriguing music from newly released albums Starship Estrada and Keep Pushin'. This is a 21 and up event. Again, that's Afro-Latin Funk Night with New Triumph, Thursday, February 8th, 9 p.m. to 12 a.m. at the Goodfoot Pub and Lounge, 2845 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm under the right side of the homepage.